Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the hour. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, but today is also a day without immigrants. Pimeros y Campesinos Unidos Noreste, or PICUN, has called on all immigrants statewide not to go to work or to school and not to shop today. It's part of their campaign to stage one day each month without an immigrant to demonstrate the many social and economic contributions of the immigrant community. Before we dive into our show today, I'd like to thank everyone who gave so generously during our end-of-year membership drive. In these perilous times, we need community institutions like KBOO that bring people together to find common cause instead of driving them apart. If you missed the opportunity to support KBOO, you can still give by going to kboo.fm/give, texting KBOO to 44321, or sending a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. With your support, community radio is alive and well in Portland. Dr. King once said, "We may have all come on different ships, but we're now in the same boat." Were he alive, MLK would have been the first to condemn the state terror campaign currently inflicted on our immigrant communities. Undoubtedly, he would have recognized it as the same terror long inflicted on the Black community. He would have known that terror campaigns are mounted to keep ordinary citizens divided and fearful of each other. As a staunch opponent of the war in Vietnam, he would have understood the connections to racial capitalism and our imperialist past and present, not to mention our history of the forced migration of Africans in chains from Africa to this country. Today, we devote our show to immigration. As your well-read read, I'm going to share a short piece on Superman as immigrant. Following that, Luisa Martinez speaks with immigration lawyer and activist Daniel Canstrom in a wide-ranging discussion about the U.S. as a deportation nation. When Superman, the latest film adaptation of our iconic superhero, was released earlier this year, right-wing commentators maligned it for being too politicized. In response, Andrew Slack and Jose Antonio Vargas published a piece, which appeared in The Hollywood Reporter in July. Here are excerpts from that article entitled, "Yes, Superman Has Always Been an Immigration Story." A link to the full piece will be posted on our page for this show. Now here are Slack and Vargas on the new film, Superman. When filmmaker James Gunn called his new Superman film an immigrant story, critics accused him of politicizing Superman. But you can't politicize the truth. Superman has been an illegal alien for 87 years. Superman entered America without papers, a baby refugee fleeing a dying planet. Like countless immigrants before him, he changed his name from the foreign-sounding, in his case Hebrew, Kal-El, to the anglicized Clark Kent. He learned new customs, balanced his heritage with his adopted culture, and used his unique abilities to serve the nation that initially feared him. This isn't subtext, it's text. Superman's creators, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, were children of Jewish immigrants who understood displacement intimately. In 1938, as Hitler rose to power, they created a hero who embodied their American dream. someone who could protect the vulnerable because he knew what it meant to be cast aside. Superman's very essence springs from being what he called a universal outsider. This outsider status isn't incidental to his heroism, it's the source of it. Those who have known rejection become champions of acceptance. Those who have felt powerless fight for the defenseless. Today, that outsider would be deported. In fact, without birthright citizenship, Superman would never have existed at all. Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, born in Cleveland to Jewish immigrant parents, would have been stripped of citizenship and deported to Nazi-controlled Europe to face certain death in countries they'd never known. No Jerry and Joe means no Superman. No Superman means no superhero genre. The children of immigrants who followed their lead, creating Batman, Captain America, Spider-Man, and at least 90% of all iconic superheroes would have met the same fate. The modern mythology that defines American popular culture worldwide, all erased. Superman endures because he represents something larger than politics, the American paradox itself. We are a nation built by the displaced, willing immigrants and unwilling slaves, refugees and dreamers, all orphaned from somewhere else. Superman, the ultimate orphan, transforms this shared wound into purpose, proving that our greatest strength comes not from where we're born, but from what we choose to become. As Trump's deportation machine accelerates, that truth feels more urgent than ever. Since 1938, Superman has defined the American way through action. In 1940, while the isolationist America First movement preached neutrality, Superman took on Adolf Hitler. In 1949, he spoke directly to school children. Quote, "If you hear anybody talk against a schoolmate because of his religion, race, or national origin, don't wait. Tell him that kind of talk is un-American." End quote. He promoted vaccines, helping fund the polio vaccine. He exposed the Ku Klux Klan's secrets on national radio. When a gunman opens fire on immigrants, blaming them for stealing his job, Superman blocks every bullet. He stood between peaceful protesters and riot police after Ferguson. After the murder of George Floyd, he declared, "Dreams save us. Dreams lift us up and transform us. And on my soul, I swear, until my dream of a world where dignity, honor, and justice becomes the reality we all share, I'll never stop fighting, ever." Superman is America's conscience wearing a cape, and that terrifies critics because they're supporting a real-life supervillain. Our greatest superpower as a nation has always been our ability to welcome the stranger and watch them soar. Like Superman himself, America draws its strength not from what it was born with, but from what it chooses to become. A place where the orphaned can find home, where the powerless can discover their power, where those who flee dying worlds can help build new ones. In choosing fear over hope, walls over welcome, we don't just betray Superman's legacy, we abort our own future. The real superheroes have always been immigrants. It's time we started acting like we believe it. That was an edited version of the piece, Yes, Superman Was Always an Immigrant Story, by Andrew Slack and Jose Antonio Vargas. A link to the full piece is posted on the webpage for this show at kboo.fm. We turn now to Luisa Martinez in conversation with Daniel Canstrom about the political economy of labor migration, the historical antecedents of current U.S. immigration policy, and immigration policy through the lenses of race, gender, poverty, and ideology. As Dr. Canstrom argues, you cannot understand immigration policy without talking about race. Daniel Canstrom is professor of law at Boston University and has decades of experience with immigration law. He is the author of Deportation Nation, Outsiders in American History, and Aftermath, Deportation Law in the New American Diaspora. Luisa Martinez is a member of Portland DSA and the National Political Committee of DSA. This interview originally aired in two parts on April 21 and 28, 2025. Due to insurmountable editing challenges, at least to me, the interview begins abruptly with a discussion about the complex politics of immigration within Mexico. The first voice you hear is Daniel Canstrom.
You know, in Mexico in particular, you know, there's such a strong sense of historical pride in that country. There's such a powerful sense of what it means to be from there. And on this side of the border, the idea is they're all just sort of like desperate people who have no culture, and that all they want is to make some money, and or else, you know, worse than that, some people think they're all criminals or whatever. But the more Mexico has ascended in the last, let's say, couple of decades economically, as you say, which is clearly true, two things have happened. One is that there has definitely been less Mexican economic migration than there ever had been before. There's still a fair number of people seeking asylum because Mexico has problems, serious problems with corruption and violence also. But those numbers have gone down. But the other thing that's happened is that Mexico has developed a pretty robust deportation system of its own for Guatemalans and Hondurans and other people coming north. So I've been working on a book in which I've been looking at that. When I first started writing the book, I thought the main story was that Mexico had been enlisted by the United States as an agent of its own exclusion and deportation policies, because the whole push, this is going back to the Obama administration, in some ways even before that, the whole idea was to push it away so that they didn't have to deal with it here, they didn't have to deal with the moral consequences and the legal consequences. But as I looked into it, I saw that was true. I mean, they were giving money, drug enforcement money, anti-terrorism money, all kinds of money, which was then being used to stop people on the roads coming north, or stop them even at the Guatemala border sometimes. But also, a lot of Mexicans supported that. And, you know, there were Mexicans in Tijuana who began to resist some of the migrant communities that were coming there. So these problems are kind of in some way like eternal, and in some ways universal, and in other ways really, really specific.
What are the economic reasons for all of these types of migrations, and how is enforcement, what drives that, and for what reason? So,
yeah, well, so ironically, both the right and the left tend to agree on this, that in terms of viewing, let's say, global migration generically as largely motivated by economic factors. The question is how you view those economic factors, and particularly in this hemisphere, you can't speak coherently about emigration and migration in the Western hemisphere to the United States without looking at the history of economic imperialism, exploitation. You know, there's both political and economic factors. I mean, people are fleeing Guatemala because it's an unstable government and there's violence, but there's also, and there's great poverty. And you can trace a lot of that back to overthrowing their government in 1954, which the United States did. So you can't talk about these things absent some understanding of that. In Mexico, you know, various initiatives over the years have really harmed the Mexican economy. Particularly in terms of things like agricultural production and so forth. And so people lost their land, they lost the opportunity to make lives where they could. And there's also a long history of recruiting workers to this country. So then the question is, what function does the border serve in that scenario? And obviously it serves a function of keeping people precarious and keeping people subject to manipulation and exploitation. You know, in Marxist terms, you could call it a reserve labor force, or you could call it a lot of different things. But there's no doubt, this is why I use the phrase post-entry social control to talk about what function does deportation serve. Well, it's a mechanism for the government, but also the government in partnership with agribusiness, for example, in certain parts of the country, or meat packers in other parts of the country. They need to keep that labor force available and pliable and docile and not able to unionize easily. You know, that's a large part of the story. It's not the only part of the story, but it is certainly a major part of the story. And I think you see that everywhere in the world. There's never an issue of people migrating from wealthier countries to poorer countries. It's always the other way around. And then the question is, how much responsibility do the wealthier countries have, not only to be humane towards the migrants, but also to recognize that a lot of the causes of that migration actually also explain the relative wealth of the country to which the people are migrating.
What is your perspective on arguments back and forth on whether or not immigrant labor depresses wages for native born people?
Yeah, that's an interesting debate. And there is some evidence, of course, that if you have a large reserve pool of workers who are willing to work for less money because they either come from a country in which they can't make anywhere near that amount of money anyway, so they're willing to work harder for less money, that is going to put some downward pressure on wages for workers in the country to which they're coming. It's also going to hinder unionization efforts. You know, the owners of the, let's call it the means of production, if you want to use Marxist terms, I'm happy to do it, are quite comfortable having a large pool of, again, controllable, precarious, docile workers who, if they act out, can simply be deported. Of course, that's going to lower wage gains. And this accounts for why American labor unions have historically had a very fraught relationship with migrant workers going back to, you know, the 19th century. Chinese workers were coming in and they were willing to work harder and cheaper and to be exploited. I mean, willing is always a questionable word in this context, but they were subject to being exploited more than U.S. workers were, who were forming labor unions on the West Coast in particular. And so those workers tended to be the vanguard of anti-immigrant sentiment a lot of times. And this is why sometimes the strongest supporters of immigration have been the wealthy or the companies that want their labor. So those of us who think about immigration tend to want to think about it in more than simply economic terms. But on the other hand, there is a counter story, which is that if the workers can stay in the country to which they come and have children, particularly in this country where their children would be U.S. citizens by birth under the 14th Amendment, not under Trump's executive order, then what happens is there's a lot of studies that show that immigrant children, the first generation, are enormously productive and benefit the economy. And so immigration is always a revitalizing force in any country in which it is allowed to flourish. My own feeling is that immigration is almost always a net benefit to any country, as long as those people have rights, as long as those people are treated with dignity and respect over time. It always works out because those people work harder. I mean, they also commit less crime. There's a lot of good studies that show that the being a citizen is a much greater predictor of criminality than being a non-citizen. Non-citizens tend to commit less crimes, they work harder, and they benefit the economy. There's also benefits to the economy even for undocumented workers who have to often have Social Security and other taxes taken out of their paychecks. And then if they get deported, they never see that money. So I don't think economic arguments actually get you to a resting point in terms of how you feel about immigration. Again, I think you have to be a little more specific about particular situations to assess whether it's a net benefit or not. But in general, my own feeling is to be supportive of immigration. I think it tends to benefit both the migrants themselves and the country to which they come.
So what of the argument that immigrant populations serve a purpose, particularly in cities and states where the population historically has been dying?
Yeah, immigration is a classic solution to the graying of the population. And this population decline is a really serious issue in a lot of countries around the world. And it accounts for a certain increasing openness to certain forms of immigration. Now, again, there's always a debate about who do we want. Part of the reason that Germany was so open to some of the people who were fleeing Syria and Iraq was that a lot of them were quite well educated and actually could plug into the German economy in ways that it was clear that they were needed. When you start talking about large numbers of relatively poor or very poor people with relatively little education, then the debates tend to be more visceral about that. But their labor is needed too, at least for the moment. Now, all of this has to be bracketed by what AI and technological developments are going to do to certain labor markets. In general, there certainly are examples around the world of many countries that are starting to think we need to open up to immigration a little bit because we're not having enough children.
Music you just heard was American Oxygen by Rihanna. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. We now return to Luisa Martinez speaking with Daniel Canstrom.
Can you explain what you feel are the most important historical precursors to the modern day deportation system?
I mean, I think first of all, it's a little bit artificial to separate out the deportation system from the exclusion system and from the general regulation of migration. But let's be clear that what we're talking about is the history of the development of a system in the United States that takes the bodies of non-citizens who have arrived here and then compels them to leave. And it could be back to the country they were born in or the country they just came from, or as we're seeing now, actually to any other country that's willing to take them. So that's deportation, the forced movement of a non-citizen out of U.S. territory. And in order to figure out the roots of that, you have to kind of break it into some pieces and think, what is that? What is the root of the idea that the government has the power to remove anybody from this country? Well, for that, you have to start asking, what is the root of the idea that people have citizenship are different from people who don't have citizenship? Because there's very little history of the government of this country forcing citizens to go anywhere else. Most people would say that that's unconstitutional, although there's nothing in the Constitution that specifically prohibits it, but it's unusual. So I started thinking or researching, like, what is the history of the idea of distinguishing people who were born here or had citizenship from people who don't? This goes back to English common law, that there was an idea that if you were born in the territory, you were subject to the sovereign, you were subject to the ruler. And if you were not, you were subject to being asked a lot of questions if you showed up. But the specific history of this system probably begins the specific legal history with the so-called Alien and Sedition Acts in the 1790 period, which is, you know, soon after the Constitution. So deportation was integral to the evolution of the U.S. government. And in that time, there was a concern about the French. They were too revolutionary. You know, the New England Federalists were really afraid of French ideology deriving from the French Revolution taking root in this country. And so they passed a law through the Congress that gave the president the authority to remove anyone who he deemed dangerous to the peace and security of this country. A remarkable law, if you think about it, to give that much discretionary power to John Adams, who was the president. But it immediately provoked a really powerful backlash. Thomas Jefferson, in particular, opposed it very strongly. And then Jefferson was elected president in 1800. So cases challenging these laws never made it into the courts. The law just was not enforced anymore after 1800 and parts of its sunset. And in that period, I started thinking or asking what was similar. And the main thing that was similar to deportation were the fugitive slave laws, which transcended individual states and gave the government, the federal government, basically the power to arrest people who had been, or to authorize the arrest of people, slaves, freed slaves, who had been deemed to be non-citizens, and then to send them back to slavery. And that, you know, those laws were terrible, and they were much resisted. That sort of got the concept in place that the federal government could remove the bodies of certain people and send them back even to, you know, bad places on the grounds that they were not citizens. It wasn't that they had committed a crime, it was just that they were not citizens, and therefore they had no right to residence in, for example, Massachusetts or New York. In addition to that, Andrew Jackson around this time and others, you know, they started forcibly removing indigenous people from their lands. So much of the removal, for example, of the Cherokee looks like a massive deportation episode if you put it into more modern terms. But basically, again, it was the federal government using its power to remove the bodies of people who were considered not to be citizens. And of course, there was still sort of an open question whether indigenous Native American people who were born on this territory were citizens under the Constitution. And that didn't get resolved for many, many years. So the main thing that really begins the deportation system as we know it is the Chinese exclusion laws and the Chinese deportation laws of the late 19th century. That's, you know, sort of a rough outline of the story. And I want to say that in all these historical periods, there were always debates about this, not only about whether it was the right or the wrong thing to do, not only about whether it was a racist and oppressive thing to do, but about whether the federal government actually had the power to do this. You know, like, where, what was this power? There's nothing in the Constitution that says the federal government shall have the power to arrest people. The only thing in the Constitution that speaks to this is a grant of authority to Congress to create a uniform rule of naturalization. So the courts had to really struggle and ask questions about where does this power come from and does it have any limits? I mean, can they just round up anybody they want and remove them? How do they prove it? And so that's where lawyers like me have come in over the generations to say how, you know, how we should look at this and what the limits of that power should be.
So you kind of opened the door regarding the racialization of how these laws have been determined.
You cannot understand the deportation system of the United States, and probably of almost any other country, without looking at race as a factor. Likewise, gender, and certainly poverty, and also ideology, but particularly race. I don't even know how anybody can argue against this, because the very first major federal immigration deportation law is grounded in something called the Chinese Exclusion Act. And the case is called the Chinese Exclusion Case. So it's explicitly race-based. And certainly the history of enforcement has always been race-based. And there can be little doubt about that. I mean, the current laws are not expressly race-based, except when you get into immigration policy and you see how the quota systems have functioned over the years, and, you know, all these questions become certainly intermeshed with racism in ways that really cannot be denied. I think the truth of it is pretty apparent. And this, again, is why I was drawn to the fugitive slave laws and the Native American Indian removal laws as antecedents to deportation, because they weren't called deportations. They were not formally considered to be exercises of federal sovereign immigration power. But I thought that functionally, they look a lot like the same thing. And one thing that they have in common is the imposition of majoritarian race-based power against what we would call in other areas of the law, a discrete and insular minority group. That is to say, particular people of color who bear the brunt of these kind of laws. So I thought, well, that's interesting. It looks pretty similar. So whether you want to call it immigration or deportation, functionally, it's quite similar. In more recent years, of course, you know, you have things like the roundup of Japanese people in the World War II period. Of course, in the Japanese case, it also got to a point where even citizenship was not a protection. And part of my own concerns about deportation is that it creates habits of mind that governments can then often expand to U.S. citizens. So people think citizenship is a total protection against deportation. That is technically true, but it is not inconceivable. And in fact, it happened in the last Trump administration and could happen in this Trump administration, that they start looking at distinguishing naturalized citizens from born citizens, that they start asking questions of people, how actually did you get your citizenship? That they start trying to deny citizenship to the children of naturalized citizens or to the children of permanent residents. I mean, once you start parsing these things, you can see that there have been examples in history of deportation forming a framework in order to go after citizens. I mean, your readers will probably be familiar with the Emma Goldman case. Emma Goldman, you know, was a very well-known activist, you know, anarchist figure of the early 20th century. She was a U.S. citizen. I mean, the first thing that happened to her was that she was denaturalized because the government argued that her citizenship had been obtained by virtue of a fraudulent marriage. And then she was deported.
So you mentioned four pillars, I'm not quite sure, but you mentioned understanding deportation and immigration laws around race, gender, ideology, and poverty. And so sticking to the U.S., could you kind of give examples about gender, at least gender and poverty?
Gender is a little more complicated and it involves certain exclusion laws. But just as an example, I think you mentioned the Page Act and some of the laws of that period that tended to construct Chinese women as being, as they said at the time, you know, prostitutes or women who are coming here for immoral purposes. There's also the factor that most women for many, many decades in this country, until fairly recently in our history, their citizenship was derivative of their husbands, and they could lose it as a result of that, and they could be exploited. Also, many fewer women had the means to travel than did men. So there's always been a gendered dimension to this. The numbers are not usually as large if you tabulate women who are deported as opposed to men, but that's more because fewer women have moved. And that's because also more of the women have tended to stay home with the children in the countries from which migrants come, and the men come here to make work. And then the families get torn apart by this. The men may find other women. The men may then get deported. So the effect of deportation on women is often both in this country, if they get deported, and also in the country from which their partners may have come in order to, you know, make money to send back home. This system of border controls puts enormous pressure on families. And it's extremely difficult to keep a family together if one of them is working in this country for years and the other is back home with the children. Particularly, the deportation system tends to lock people in. So whereas we had many generations of Mexican, again, it was mostly Mexican men crossing the border back and forth so they could be with their families. Once you have a deportation system in place, let alone a wall or, you know, the kind of militarization that you're seeing, now suddenly it's a much higher stakes thing to be able to get to this country. And you have to stay for as long as you possibly can to make as much money as you possibly can, because each crossing becomes that much more difficult. I mean, certainly there have been women who have been deported as well. Around the world, you see more of a gendered aspect of this, particularly in countries like in the Middle East, where you have domestic workers who are sent by the Philippines, for example, and who live in extremely precarious situations where they have very few rights. They can be easily abused. And even if they get pregnant, it's considered a breach of their contract and they can be deported for that. That has not been a major component in the United States. And there have also been many concerns over many years raised about women who are in abusive relationships, non-citizen women who have been exploited by U.S. citizen partners, but who have been unable to raise that claim because they were then fearing that they would get deported if they came to the attention of the authorities.
Perhaps maybe 20 years ago, in the social imagination of the United States, immigration was represented basically by a single man, what you were saying before, a young single man. Now it's less about single men, young single men, and more families, right? And so the narrative starts to shift a little bit in terms of the social debate from they're taking our jobs to now they're taking our resources.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's been particularly true among certain groups, like the people coming up from Guatemala and much of the migration from Mexico. It's still less true among like Africans or those who have to make longer journeys to get here. But many of those, maybe most of those, I would say, are refugees with asylum claims who are more fleeing, you know, political persecution. But you're right about that. And that is true that the current narrative is much about public schools and emergency rooms. Of course, this was true in the past. I mean, the major Supreme Court case about whether the undocumented children of undocumented people have a right to a public school education was decided in 1982. And I'm very worried about that precedent because that was a 5-4 decision even then. And that was during when there were many more liberal justices on the court. So these issues are not entirely new. I think family migration has caused a lot of disturbing examples of, you know, children being separated from their mothers. Of course, that's been a horrific example during the last Trump administration. But families being locked up altogether was not a good thing either. And that happened on a very large scale during the Obama administration. So the movement of families together creates enormous difficulties. And there does tend to be resistance when large numbers of migrants enter the public school system or the hospitals and so forth. It was somewhat foreseeable that what is happening now in New York, the sort of reactionary politics that develop when the mayor of New York, you know, said this will bankrupt the city of New York if we don't get funding. I mean, these states that had shelter laws that activists had worked very hard to create for unhoused people. And, you know, I thought those were really progressive laws. But then there is a point where they do become overwhelmed. And so unless you have some federal support, it does create backlash. And I think we're seeing a lot of that now. And my guess is that the Trump administration, once they start asking everybody on buses and trains to show papers, is going to provoke the opposite sort of backlash when people realize that it's not a clear us and them, that we U.S. citizens tend to be married to many of them. And we know many, like we're all sort of in this together. And if the government starts enforcing these laws through school raids and church raids and hospital raids and asking everybody to show their papers everywhere, you know, you're going to see a backlash of a different type. Now, people on the left have made very strong arguments against borders entirely. That debate strikes me at the moment as a little bit anachronistic, because I think we're not at a point where we can really have that discussion.
You don't believe in open borders, or at least don't think that that's a realistic demand. So could you talk about, yeah, your position on that?
Not only do I not think it's a realistic demand, and it is clearly not a realistic demand. There is no history of this being accepted, except in very constrained, very limited, very unique circumstances, for example, Europe, or certain experiments among relatively small numbers of countries in South America. But in the places where it would be the most needed, it sparks the greatest resistance. And I think it could lead to actual some really bad consequences. I think, for example, about what is my position on the border policies of Ukraine, or on the border policies of Tibet. Borders represent a conflict between two extremely powerful, extremely fundamental human attributes. One is the human need to move. I think we have always been creatures of movement. That's part of our story. And it's a survival skill. To be human is to be capable of thinking about moving. And this applies whether you're from Chile coming to the U.S. or from the U.S. thinking about Mars. I mean, I think it's just part of humanity is the need to move. But the other part of humanity, which I think is equally important, is the need to form communities and to have communities that are stable over time, so that I want my children, I want to have some sense of what the world is going to be for my children. And for that reason, I want to create something in the nature of as stable a community as I possibly can for them. If you agree with that, then the question becomes, what sorts of boundaries should communities have? And this is a question of the nature of characteristics. So you could base a community on race, or you could base it on religion. And I don't like those things. I think a community could be based most legitimately on shared values, on, you know, a certain shared cultural history, certain agreements like a constitution. And the second question is, what is the appropriate size of a community? What's the right level? So having thought about this for many years, I very much respect the position of the people who critique the border. I think the border can often be and almost always has been an instrument of a certain form of oppression, but it has also been a protective mechanism for communities. And I think the task is to first of all ask, is the nation state a reasonable form of human organization to mediate these things? And if not, what's better? Now, some people say maybe the city is the better form, you know, maybe being more local. That gives greater voice to the people. It allows more experiments, more fluidity of cultural development and so forth. I'm willing to have that discussion. And there have been city states historically that have been very important, Rome, for example. But for me, the question is not, should the nation state exist or should the border exist, but what power should the government have to enforce those borders, and what limits should be set on that power? And this is where I think human rights and international law and certain fundamental ideas of freedom of movement become really important. And that's why I think the UN system was right to build in not only sovereignty, but human rights into the very creation of the United Nations system in the post-war period. I realize this might seem kind of quaint and anachronistic, but I do think that if you eliminated borders, people would recreate community probably on grounds that we would find even less appealing than the civic form of the nation state. And so I like to devote my efforts to fighting for the rights of people on the move when they encounter government power. And I think that's a really important venue for rights, because the victories that you get at that point also tend to resonate in positive ways into the society. In immigration studies and in sovereignty studies and in deportation defense work, the individual at the absolute lowest moment of her power and status and life chances encounters the nation state in all of its glory, in its absolute strongest form. And so the question is, what can the individual say at that moment? What can the individual do? So I also look at activism across borders, how people develop solidarity across borders. But I'm saying that I think that's a place where we don't have to abolish the border in order to render it much, much more humane and much, much more amenable to other types of legal constraints, which I think would be positive. International coordination among providers of social services and education and all that, that's important, because it can bring a measure of activism across the border in positive ways and protect people. And I think rights generically, you know, as a legal construct, have this feature that they're not limited to one particular nation state. So operating within a rights framework is consonant with trying to transcend the border. And it doesn't necessarily require a theory of the ultimate elimination of the border.
Thank you.
That was Chris Ray with his song Immigration Blues. I'm Patricia Kullberg with the Old Mall Variety Hour. Now here's the conclusion to Luis's interview with Daniel Canstrom.
I did want to get your perspective as an immigration law scholar, professor. In what ways, if any, do you believe that the current administration deviates from a Democratic president like Obama and his administration when it comes to immigration? Materially, the impacts, not the rhetoric, right? How do you understand the differences?
The differences in practice are quite profound. Obama was criticized for ramping up certain types of deportations, for putting in place a program that they called, for example, Felons Not Families, which I did not support. I thought they spent a lot of time trying to differentiate the sort of good migrants from the bad migrants and justify certain types of deportation. On the other hand, they were supporting DACA, they were supporting DAPA, they did have refugee admissions, they were allowing people to apply for asylum. These are not small things. If you're asking, is there a difference between, for example, what the George W. Bush administration did after 9/11, calling in young Muslim American men for mandatory registration and interviews, or what the Trump administration is proposing now, eliminating the 14th Amendment right of birthright citizenship and implementing a carry your papers regime for everybody and threatening criminal prosecution for people who have been in this country for decades? Yeah, I think there's a big difference there. Much of the history of immigration law in this country has been a struggle between actors like the current Trump administration who want to see a regime of power and expeditious deportation of the maximum number of people and the creation of the maximum amount of fear. I mean, they say it, they want people to be scared and they think that they'll voluntarily self-deport because of that. And of course, precarity, which is a formula for exploitation, versus people who have said, no, we have to welcome people, we have to treat people with dignity and respect, and we have to put into place legal protections for people. So the reason a lot of people in this country are not subject to expedited removal, although millions are, is because of victories that took place in the legal system, using the language of due process, and trying to build little by little rights into some of these statutes and into a court system that said, for example, as I've said in my own work, if you're deporting a person, that's really not different from prosecuting them for crime, and that person should have similar rights to a criminal defendant. Like, why do we give anybody rights? There are two reasons. One is because you want to respect the dignity of the individual, but the other is because you want to restrain the power of government from excessive arbitrariness and excessive cruelty. So I think that's the struggle now, and we happen to be in a moment where the government is going to be in need of some restraint, and that's why we have laws, and that's why we have courts, but also that's where activism and organizing in cooperation with laws comes into place. Now, a lot of lawyers find themselves in a very difficult position right now. I was just asked yesterday, you know, would I advise a client not to comply with the mandatory registration laws? As a lawyer, you actually cannot ethically advise a client to violate the law. But what I can say to a client is, this is a really hard decision, and I want to have enough respect so that I can give you enough information so that you can make the decision on your own. There are going to be consequences either way, and I can't tell you what to do.
So what would you say, given the conditions, given a right-wing majority in Congress, given a right-wing majority in Supreme Court, what do you do in that case, where it seems like the deck is stacked against one in all the branches?
Well, again, as one who tries to take the long view on these things, I remember being asked by DACA eligible people 13 years ago whether I thought they should apply for DACA. And I remember saying to them exactly what I just said to you, which is, this is a really hard decision. And I don't think you should think it's an easy decision, because once you put yourself into a government database, once you reveal yourself, you're giving up one of the most powerful protections people in precarious situations have, which is anonymity. And I think a person should think long and hard about that. Governments change. I mean, the history of this country has been a history of very strenuous enforcement and massive deportation. That's why I wrote the book. Deportation has been integral to the United States from the very beginning. This is a down period. This is a very hard period. But, you know, there were aspects of the Roosevelt administration that were like this. There were aspects of the Eisenhower administration in which we saw massive deportations of millions of people back to Mexico. So in some ways, it's not unique. It is particularly harsh right now and particularly cruel. But there are limits. I mean, there's a question of how they're going to get the resources to deport anywhere near the number of people that they're talking about. Again, as I said, you can create a show me your papers law. But once they start asking U.S. citizens to show papers, particularly U.S. citizens of color, which is probably the more likely thing that's going to start happening, you're going to start seeing resistance. You know, if they actually start raiding schools and churches, you're going to see massive resistance to that. I mean, even Kristi Noem, I think, was facing pushback in South Dakota, where people were saying, if you start deporting all the non-citizen, the undocumented workers from the meatpacking plants, we're going to drown in our cows. It's very hard to unravel this entire system over the course of one administration. I think it's a question of staying calm and carrying on and picking your battles.
Well, I did want to ask about your understanding of how U.S.-backed illegal sanctions against countries, particularly in Latin America, but you're welcome to talk about the Global South, the relationship to immigration and deportation in this country.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting feature of this administration, although, again, not entirely historically unique, but using economic pressure and things like tariffs to compel governments to transform their own migration policies or their own reception policies to fit more what the U.S. wants. You know, there's certainly a long history of that kind of thing. My guess is that usually, historically, bullying promotes a certain facile veneer of acquiescence, but not actual cooperation. And I think, for example, the government of Mexico is going to do things that, you know, move some troops to the border, take some people back, pick up enforcement, but they're going to pursue the policy that they think is best for Mexico in the long run. There's a lot of bullying that's going on now, threatening to take back the Panama Canal or to make Canada the 51st state. To me, this is not serious policy, and I think it'll wear thin quickly, and you'll start seeing pushback and reaction, which may be overt or may be covert, by a lot of the countries in Latin America, in particular, that have, you know, their own histories and their own governments and their own concerns. They're not that easy to manipulate or push around on a large scale. You know, Panama has one hotel where they can take a certain number of people, but we're talking about 11 million or more. There may be, you know, somewhere between 11 and 20 million undocumented people in this country. I don't see how you're going to have the wherewithal, A, to implement that sort of a program in this country, given budgetary constraints and legal constraints. So you'd have to really create a police state, because there's no way to differentiate the citizen from the non-citizen just by looking at them. And then the question is, who's going to take them back? Like, where are they going to go? That destabilizes the countries that you're deporting people to, which then creates new flows of ever more desperate migrants. I mean, people don't usually leave their homes unless they have a very powerful reason for doing it. And if you start undercutting the economies of the other countries in the hemisphere, you're just recapitulating the same dynamic that created this situation in the first place. But I agree with you about the ideology of the American dream, you know, but it is somewhat interesting to say, if you want to understand the migration and deportation policies of the Trump administration, read the poem at the base of the Statue of Liberty and then just presume the exact opposite. So, you know, it says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. It's the opposite. If you're tired, you can't work, we don't want you. If you're poor, we certainly don't want you. We want golden visas. If you're yearning to breathe free, you're a socialist or an anarchist or a communist, and we certainly don't want you. You know, but that's been true of the United States for decades. Yeah, let me say one last thing. You asked about the difference between refugees and migrants, and this is an important thing, because there has been a history of humanitarian protections for people who are fearing at least certain kinds of persecution. And of course, one can be critical of the boundaries of the refugee laws. They only protect political refugees, not economic refugees. That's all an important discussion to have. But shutting off the door, closing the door to refugees and asylum seekers is really, really a feature of this administration that I think is abominable and really cruel. And, you know, I've known so many people over the course of my life as a lawyer who have genuine asylum claims and they need to be protected. And it's just terrible to see that system being rejected and diminished.
Okay, well, obviously, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
That's a wrap for the show today. I want to thank Louisa for her interview and a special thanks to our guest, Daniel Canstrom. I'm going to leave you today with this song by La Santa Cecilia called Ice El Hielo. Until next Monday, stay safe and above all, stay active.
Ice, water frozen solid. Ice, immigration and customs enforcement. Ice, el hielo.
Va pasando el trapo sobre la mesa y está cuidando que todo brille como una perla. Cuando llegue la patrona, que no se vuelva a quejar, no sea cosa que la acuse de ilegal. José atiende los jardines, parecen de Disneyland. Maneja una troca vieja sin la licencia. No importa si fue taxista allá en su tierra natal. Eso no cuenta para el tío Sam. Hielo anda suelto por esas calles. Nunca se sabe cuándo nos va a tocar.